You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
I'm going to be talking mostly about this report. It's based on the report that was that you've just mentioned, but it's a little bit broader than that. So I'm going to try and put the debate around social protection and food security linkages into a slightly broader context. So let me start with a bit of prehistory. We're going to go all the way back to the 1980s. So I work at the Institute of Development Studies in Sussex, and when I joined IDS, I actually didn't join in the 1980s, I joined in the 1990s. But food security was a very big theme. In fact, I was first recruited in as a food security researcher. And then somewhere in the late 1990s, food security just disappeared. Around the same time, well, maybe just after agriculture research disappeared. So for a long time, agriculture and food security were off the agenda. But in the 1980s and 90s, it was a very big topic at IDS and in development studies generally. So we had, for example, this book by Singer, Wood and Jennings about food aid. And of course, food aid already tells you that there are linkages because food aid is also a social protection policy or instrument, although it wasn't called that in those days. There was also a very seminal work by Robert Chambers and others on seasonality and rural livelihoods, which is also strongly food security oriented. Moving to the 1990s, there was some conceptual work done by people like Simon Maxwell on conceptual approaches to household food security. So it became a very big sub-genre within development studies. And then we did some work sort of pulling together some research that was done in African countries in the late 1990s. So that was kind of the end of food security. When the new millennium came along, social protection was invented. So we started doing a lot of work on social protection. So this is an IDS bulletin looking at social protection debates, topical issues like how to target or whether you should target at all, cash versus food, conditionalities, those kinds of issues. So we've done a lot of work in the 2000s on social protection, and this is a book called Social Protection in Asia, which was written by Sarah Cook, among others. So Sarah did lots of work when she was at IDS on social protection before she moved on to higher things. We've done work on social protection in Africa as well. And more recently, we've been focusing quite a lot on social protection and social justice, which is the new rights agenda that's coming into social protection. And that's also part of the focus of my talk today. So I think what I see as I look over these last 20 or 30 years of work on social protection and food security is the question posed by the title, two sides of the same coin. When I started working on rural development in Africa, which has always been my focus really, food security was, or food insecurity was the problem. I worked a lot on famines as well as regular chronic food insecurity. And then social protection came along and offered a whole range of solutions, or at least instruments that could partly address some food insecurity problems, let's put it like that. So social protection clearly is a policy agenda which talks very directly to problems of food insecurity. Whether they overlap completely is a more technical discussion, but we'll come to some of those debates later as well. Okay, so that's the context, if you like. Now, the Committee on World Food Security commissioned this report, this one here, Social Protection and Food Security, which you can download from the website, which was an attempt to bring these two agendas together. Food security and agriculture and nutrition are back on the agenda again. If you hang around long enough, everything comes back. So they're all back on the agenda again. And social protection is already there, so let's try and pull them together. So just a bit of background on the CFS and the HLPE. The CFS was reformed after the food price crisis when it was recognized that global governance of food security wasn't working very well. And one of the things that they did in the reform process is that they set up a semi-independent body called the High-Level Panel of Experts, which was intended to provide independent, cutting-edge research or at least state-of-the-art reviews of evidence on topical issues, which could inform policy, especially for the member states of the CFS. So it's meant to be fairly accessible. It's meant to be putting together rather than original research. And I think it's meant to be very policy-oriented as well. So that's a little bit of the context of the institutional context, if you like, of this report. What one of the main activities of the High-Level Panel of Experts is to commission two reports every year. They have this very tight cycle where they churn out these two reports between October and June every year. And so the first year, they produced two reports following the food price crisis about price volatility, and also about land tenure, which is really focusing on land grabbing as a very topical issue. And the second year was my year, when I worked on the social protection report, and at the same time there was another one on climate change. So four reports in 2 years, and right now those have been published. Right now they're in the middle of the third cycle, which is producing a report on biofuels and another one on smallholder investment. So you can see they're not scared to take on big politically charged issues. And I think I got off lucky, because in my year, climate change got all the political attention and I was left alone, because everybody likes social protection. So it was quite an easy one to do politically. So the reports are meant to be both evidence-based. They're meant to review what we know, what the state of knowledge is about a topic. But also, they're meant to be used for advocacy. And that gave us an interesting dilemma, if you like, because it's not easy if you're working with, there was a team of five of us, including a World Bank economist. And the World Bank economist was very keen on the evidence side of things. But we also had a human rights lawyer who focuses very much on the right to food, and she wanted to do more on the advocacy side. So bringing those two together and trying to make a coherent statement, which was both evidence-based and advocacy, was probably the main challenge that I faced as a team leader for this report. Okay, so what does the report say? Well, the question obviously that we have to ask is, what do we mean by social protection for food security? What does the title actually say? And the title's got these two elements. Social protection. So social protection, these are not technical definitions, these are just popular definitions. But social protection is a range of instruments that address poverty and vulnerability, and of course that includes food insecurity. By social assistance, which means transfers mainly, cash or food transfers. By social insurance or social security, like unemployment insurance or pensions. And measures to promote social inclusion, which is, if you like, the more rights-based side of social protection. That's not included in all definitions, but we had it in ours. And food insecurity, again, not the technical definition, because once you get into that minefield, you could be all day just talking about that definition. But we talked about food insecurity as being the inability to secure enough food today and the risk of being unable to do so in the future. So that includes the dynamic dimension, because it's about vulnerability. It's not just about your current state. It's about what might happen to you tomorrow. So when we talk about social protection for food security, bringing these two together, we're talking about using social protection instruments in order to promote the human right to adequate food for all. So you can see there already we're trying to bring together this technical agenda, which is a bunch of social protection instruments, with the political objective of securing the right to food. And that's, I would say, if there's any innovation in this report, which, as I said, is basically a literature review, I think that's where it's innovative. It's trying to pull those two agendas together. And these are the rights that we are drawing on, the right to adequate food, which is well established. And for social protection, we're drawing on the right to social security, which there's a big debate, which we could discuss if you want to, about whether social protection is bigger than social security, or whether social security covers social protection, which one is inside the other one's circle. But basically, social protection and social security we're using interchangeably in this report. So we're drawing on those two rights from the UN Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Okay, here comes a conceptual framework, and I think this might be hopefully the only one that you can't see too well, but I won't spend too much time talking about the detail. I want to just frame what we mean by social protection instruments in terms of this analytical framework, which is just a way of organizing different social protection tools, if you like. So if you take some kind of poverty line, usually it could be a dollar a day or it could be a food poverty line, and you have people that are already below the poverty line, they need social assistance if they are unable to generate an independent livelihood. So that could be cash transfers or food aid. So that's on the bottom left. And that pulls them up towards the poverty line. We don't find with most social protection programs that people actually escape from poverty just by the social protection program. They're often too far below the poverty line, and the transfers are too small and erratic to get them out of poverty, but at least makes them less poor. So it reduces the poverty gap, even if it doesn't reduce the poverty headcount very much. On the other side, you have people that have livelihoods or potential for livelihoods, and they can benefit from income-generating activities. And for those people, you would link the social protection program to asset creation. So providing access to assets, which would help people actually escape from poverty, which is why that arrow goes above the poverty line. And down here, you have what we're calling the twin-track approach, which is combining social assistance with support for income generation. And I'm going to spend more time talking about two of these instruments because they're actually quite interesting in terms of this connection between social protection, which is seen often as a welfare-type agenda, with livelihood promotion, which is seen more as a developmental agenda. Above the line, you have risk management tools. And of course, as I said, food security is also about getting enough food tomorrow. So if you are a farmer and you face a drought, or if you are employed and you lose your job, what happens? If you are in a formal employment situation, you might have access to social security. But if you are informal sector or self-employed farmer, you probably don't. So there are mechanisms which are now being pulled into the social protection umbrella, which include life, you know, crop and livestock insurance or weather-indexed insurance. Of course, contributory social insurance would fit in that as well. Social security fits in there as well. And finally, on the right-hand side, I would like to just emphasize that social protection has become increasingly reduced, if you like, to a set of targeted interventions which are delivered to individuals or households. But we shouldn't forget that often the structural problems that people face are better addressed by structural interventions. So risk reduction measures, which could operate at the sector level, for example, stabilizing prices by managing a national grain reserve, where you know, the government buys grain after the harvest and then releases it later on when food prices start to rise, that could stabilize the food prices without targeting individuals with cash transfers or food aid. And those mechanisms are not so popular these days. So when we look at the social protection menu, we tend to focus very much on social assistance and social insurance. We don't focus very much on risk reduction measures that operate at a higher level, although in my personal view, I think this is a mistake. I think we have neglected those sector-level or macro-level interventions with this focus on individualization of social protection programs. So we want to talk about those macro or meso-level interventions as well. Okay, I'm now going to talk about two instruments in detail. In the report, we focus on 10 from that menu, from that framework, but I've chosen two that are interesting because they are controversial and because they illustrate many of the arguments that we make in the report more generally. So if you want to pick up on any of the other instruments that I don't talk about now, you can certainly do that in discussion. I'm going to talk about public works programs, and I'm going to talk about conditional cash transfers. So public works programs are temporary employment programs which are created in response to poverty and food insecurity, which is caused by unemployment or underemployment. So, for example, people who are farming for half the year, but half the year there's no work while they're waiting for the next rainy season, they could benefit from temporary employment during those 6 months. Now, public works programs are an example of a twin-track approach, which we advocate quite strongly in the report, because on the one hand, they support short-term food security by giving people a cash wage or a food ration, cash for work or food for work. And at the same time, the work that people are doing on these projects is meant to generate useful assets. So often people are building roads, or in this case, this is from a project I looked at in Rwanda, they're actually terracing a hillside to make land available for farming. And you'll find lots of soil and water conservation activities, but also community infrastructure like school buildings can be built with public works as well. So there's two objectives here, short-term and long-term food security. And of course, public works programs are extremely controversial. So the evidence shows, the review of evidence that we looked at, shows that they are effective for many reasons. One reason is that they are self-targeting, and that's one reason that they're very popular with governments and donors, because it's very difficult often to identify who are the poorest who should benefit from a program. But public works programs are self-targeting because it's hard work and you don't get paid very much. So most of us wouldn't really want to go and dig a road for 6 hours a day for 3 kilograms of rice, but often that's what you're doing on public works projects. So that makes it targeting the very poorest. It's effective against shocks and seasonality because it provides that safety net. It provides an employment-based safety net which can smooth consumption over good and bad years or between hungry season and harvest season. And it can create useful infrastructure, but emphasis on the word can, because one of the controversies about public works is how effectively they do actually create useful infrastructure that is sustainable. So let's come to the critiques of public works programs. The first one is that obviously the work requirement, well, it is obvious, but it's not often thought through. If you have people expending a lot of energy digging a road, and then you give them a bit of food at the end of the day, or a bit of cash to buy food, you have to reduce the net value of that transfer by the amount of energy they've expended. And there's one notorious case from the literature when a project, I think it was in Niger, people were getting paid a food ration for a food work project, but when you measured their anthropometric status, they were actually worse off after the project than before. They expended more energy digging the road than they actually received back in terms of payment. So that's not a good outcome. There's also an ethical question about the self-targeting. Is it ethical to pay people very low wages? Because if you have mass poverty in a rural area, you have to set the wage really, really low just to attract the 200 or 300 people that you need to build the road. So you make it so low that it becomes, I would argue, unethical, below the market wage rate, definitely. If you're making people do heavy labor, then that excludes people who can't do heavy labor. So older people, people who are ill, many women who are either labor constrained or time constrained and can't do that work. And finally, as I said, the assets that are created often don't benefit the poor directly. In the case of this project, it actually does. So this is a good example of where you can make the asset useful for the people working on the project. But often, of course, because it's labor intensive, it's not going to be very high quality public work. So sometimes buildings that are built, classrooms and so on, don't last very long, roads deteriorate. And often there's no budget for maintenance. When the project ends, that's it. So the asset starts to deteriorate quite rapidly, and sometimes you end up building the same road over and over again every few years. So these reasons have made public works controversial. But despite all this, I personally am not opposed to public works. I think a lot of these questions are design issues. And a lot of the problems that we have with social protection programs, which are controversial, can be solved by good design. So there's no reason why we couldn't apply decent work principles to public works programs. There's no reason why you have to use the wage rate as a self-targeting mechanism. You can pay people a decent wage and use another mechanism for targeting. In some cases, employment is rotated. So you work for a month and then somebody else, another group of people come work for a month and so on. Or you can use other mechanisms for identifying who should be on the program. You can also make sure that people who can't work on the public works still get access to social protection by some other means. So in many cases, there's a large program in Ethiopia called the Productive Safety Net Program, which is 80% public works, but then 20% is unconditional cash transfers to people who can't work. And that covers the problem of some people not being able to access the social grants because they can't deliver the work. You can also design lighter work for women, and sometimes public works projects have got a creche where women working on the project leave their children with other women who can't do the work on the road project, for example. And, for example, this baby here, that baby there should be in the creche, which could be run by some other woman. And finally, in terms of making sure that projects are useful for the local people, you involve the communities. Obviously, that would be a way of getting around that problem. Make sure that the communities help to decide which projects are selected, and also make sure a maintenance budget is built in so that the asset doesn't deteriorate immediately after the project ends. So my point about public works, to sum up, is it's a controversial instrument, but it shouldn't be thrown out because it has lots of potential to be done well. The problem is we hear a lot of bad stories. We're used to in the past. It's improved a lot. But those bad stories tend to give public works a bad name. So it's, I think a large part of it is about how you design it. And if you design it well, you can get around a lot of these problems. So I'm going to move on to another very controversial one, which is conditional cash transfers. Now, conditional cash transfers are cash that's given to poor people, usually to mothers or caregivers, but only with certain conditions. And the conditions are meant to be socially progressive conditions. So it's about making sure that the children in the household go to school, that they get immunized, giving nutrition education to the mothers, those kinds of things. Who could disagree? So conditionalities are applied in order to achieve secondary objectives. So the first objective, this is again a twin-track program, the first objective is to reduce short-term food insecurity or poverty by giving the household a cash transfer, which they can use for anything they like. There's no condition on the cash transfer. So it's an unconditional cash grant, but with conditions on the behavior of the household, not on the use of the grant. But the conditions are meant usually to build the human capital of the children in the household, hopefully with a longer-term objective of they'll be better educated and better nourished and healthier, so they'll get better livelihoods when they grow up. They'll perform better at school, and when they grow up they can get an income which will get them out of poverty. So the objective is ambitious, to try and break the intergenerational transmission of poverty. We don't have evidence on this because although CCDs have been going for about 15 or almost 20 years now, especially in Latin America, that still isn't a whole generation. What we really need to do is track children from these households and see what happens to them when they grow up. Are they actually going to grow up to be less poor than their parents? Are they going to escape poverty? So we don't have evidence on the longer-term effects yet. But we do have evidence on their positive impacts, and they do certainly have positive impacts. So definitely the evidence is very conclusive. CCTs improve food security. People who get these cash transfers do spend them on food, and they get a more diverse diet, a better quality diet. And, of course, because the conditions are linked usually to education and health, you'll find that children in these households do go to school more often. They are more likely to be immunized. So you see these increases in attendance rates, enrollment rates, and immunization rates. Very importantly, they get a lot of political support, because in countries where social protection programs are financed domestically by taxpayers, the middle classes tend to prefer that the poor do something in return for getting the cash, rather than just getting handouts. So you'll find a strong ethos, a strong rhetoric against unconditional cash transfers, because people say this just creates dependency, it makes people lazy, you know, poor people should go out and look for jobs, all those kind of things. But at least with a conditional cash transfer, the poor people who get the cash are supposed to do something for themselves. So there is a political support for these programs that you don't often get for unconditional grants. Okay, so what's the controversy? Sounds good. But here are some more reasons why they are unpopular than reasons why they are popular. So firstly, when you introduce a conditionality, it makes the program more expensive. You have to monitor compliance, and that can be a large part of the program budget. If people aren't complying, you have to decide what to do. Do you kick them out of the program, in which case you've denied them a right to a cash transfer, if it's a rights-based program? Or do you go around to the household and try and find out what the problem is, do a sort of caseworker approach, and support the household to get the kids back to school or whatever it is? And that all takes time and resources, which many low-income countries don't have. Secondly, there's no point having a conditionality on education or health if the education and health services aren't there, or they're very poor quality. So we shouldn't... One of my complaints about conditional cash transfers is that they assume that parents are irrational, that they're not sending the kids to school and clinic because they don't see the point of it. But maybe there is no point in sending the kids to schools and clinics if the school education quality is so poor that they're not learning anything, or if they just go to the clinic and get a Disprin or Panado every time. So if the services aren't there, accessible, or of good enough quality, it doesn't make sense to force parents to comply with these conditions. There's also an empirical debate, which is at the moment unresolved. This is one of the cutting-edge issues in conditional cash transfers, about whether the conditions are actually necessary to achieve these desired outcomes at all. So the question is, if you give people cash, is that enough for them to spend some of this extra cash on education and health services anyway, or do you need to force them to do it with a conditionality? And the evidence that we have from unconditional cash transfers is that households do buy health and education services with some of that cash anyway. So it might be that it's an income constraint rather than a behavioral constraint, if you like, that needs to be addressed. There's a gender complaint as well about conditional cash transfers, which is that all the pressure for compliance tends to end up being on the mother or the caregiver, who's often usually female. And that means that the mother and the caregiver is the one who has to make sure the children are going to school and clinic. And nonetheless, the cash often ends up in the hands of the man in the household. So more pressure on the women, but not necessarily more benefits to the women. And one more, there is this rights question. And as I said at the beginning, we are looking at social protection from a rights-based perspective in this report. There is a question about whether it makes sense to attach conditions to social transfers that should be a right. If you believe in the right to social security or the right to social protection, how can you deny that right just because people don't behave in the way that you think that they should? So there is a question about the ethics of applying a conditionality to what should be a rights-based program. So in fact, conditional cash transfers are not rights-based programs. They can't be. One more point. Any cash transfer, not just conditional, any cash transfer is vulnerable to food price inflation, either seasonal price variations or food price spikes like we had in 2007-08. So on the right-hand side here, you can see what happened to food prices in Ethiopia in 2007. They shot up dramatically. And, of course, cash transfers that were implemented in Ethiopia through the product safety net program at that time were not index-linked. So they didn't follow the rising food prices. So the value of the cash transfers fell dramatically, which always happens when cash transfers are not index-linked, and most cash transfers aren't. At the bottom, you have an example of a seasonal food price increase, which happened in Malawi. So the line is a food price trend. You can see how it goes up, and then it falls when the harvest comes in. But for those 3 or 4 months before the harvest, prices were very high, as they are every year. And in this case, there was actually a program, which is represented by the bars, that gave people enough cash every month to meet the rising price of food until it started coming down, and then they reduced the cash transfer. So that was an example of where prices were index-linked at the local level every single month. But it's an extremely complex operation to do, and I personally don't think it'll ever be replicated. It was extremely expensive and difficult for the donor and the NGO concerned, but they did try and make sure that cash transfers were adequate to buy the same basket of food, whatever the price. So as the food price went up, so did the cash transfer. But without that kind of index linking, you're going to find that cash transfers lose their value as prices rise. Okay, so those are two instruments. We looked at 10, as I said. There are others in the report. But social protection is not just about instruments. It's about systems. Or in this part of the world, it's about flaws, social protection flaws, which I'll also talk about. So to sum up about instruments, it's quite an interesting paradox that social protection is very popular in theory. Everybody says, great, we like social protection. But then when you look at instruments one by one, you find lots of controversy about them. You know, public works, conditional cash transfers, school feeding. These are not subsidies. Any type of subsidy raises all kinds of alarm bells. So there are paradoxes around this. And my own view is that a large part of it is bad design, because in principle these are good programs, they have good ideas, but then in practice they can be badly implemented or badly designed, so you get the wrong kind of outcomes, or you get suboptimal outcomes. So often what's needed is just to improve the design and make sure it's implemented properly. But design, and we're learning a lot from evaluations about how to improve the design of these programs so that they can be transformed from, you know, problematic programs to really successful programs. In terms of which instruments, this is a question we were also asked, how do you decide, you know, do you want to have a school feeding program or a public works program? My own view on this, and it's in the report, is that you should do some kind of analysis of what the problem is before you come along with a solution. And that sounds straightforward, but it's not how the world works, because in the real world you have donor agencies that have food, you have donor agencies that have cash, you have donor agencies that are in favor of conditional cash transfers, and those that prefer school feeding. So it's often a political decision rather than based on a needs assessment, but really it should be based on a needs assessment, and a national government-owned program would be based on a needs assessment rather than donor agendas or whatever resources are available. Another point to make is that it's not just about one instrument. There is no single instrument, and anybody who thinks that all the problems of poverty and food insecurity can be solved with cash transfers is wrong. You need to have a bunch of interventions. You need different people have got different problems. Food security is very complex. So you need to have a set of interventions that address different food insecurity issues, and you should also be linking those programs to other sectors. Because, for example, if you're going to have a conditional cash transfer, that's a demand-side intervention, increasing the demand for health and education. The supply side must be adequate. So health and education services must be strong enough to absorb the extra demand that a conditional cash transfer is going to generate. So you have linkages also to productive or economic sectors like agriculture and employment preferably, so that you don't just generate huge social protection programs in isolation from the wider economy. And finally, a very important issue, which is again part of the new emerging rights agenda, is that we argue that accountability mechanisms are very important to make sure that instruments, programs, policies are implemented effectively. And those accountability mechanisms should operate at the national level, which means Ultimately, there should be a social contract between governments and citizens or residents, which means that everybody knows what their entitlements are and that you can claim those entitlements. So we shouldn't just be looking at discretionary projects where, you know, a project arrives in your village for 6 months and you're lucky if you get on it and then it stops. And it should be based on national systems which are claims-based. So you know you're entitled to a pension because you're 65 years old and you are poor. And at the program level, we should have, and most programs are now thinking more and more about introducing this, some kinds of grievance procedure or complaints mechanism where people who feel that they have been unfairly excluded from the program, for example, can go and make their case and try and get on the program. Or if your payment doesn't arrive on time, or if there's a corrupt official who's taking half your money, you can go and get that rectified. And that builds accountability from the bottom up. So we're talking about top-down accountability with the social contract idea, but also bottom-up, making citizens able to claim their entitlements from the state and to hold the program implementation people to account. So moving from instruments to systems, I'm now going to talk about a few issues around systemic approaches to social protection. And one which is very topical at the moment, very popular again, is graduation. And graduation basically means that people who are on a program should not stay on that program indefinitely, but at a certain point should exit the program. So if you are, for example, getting some kind of livelihood support, then you should at some point not need that livelihood support any longer. And at that point, you exit the program because you are either food secure or you're not poor anymore. But the question then is, how do you define the appropriate point that people should exit the program? And what happens if you are out of the program for a year, but then you fall back into poverty or food insecurity? Do you get back on the program, or are you out forever? So there's also very interesting questions around this whole notion of graduation. But let me give you two examples of how it's being applied in practice. The one is a BRAC project in Bangladesh, and this one is extremely successful. I must say I haven't been to see it myself, so I'm not sure, but for what I've read about it, it's very convincing. Hundreds of thousands of women have apparently graduated from extreme poverty to moderate poverty, which doesn't mean they got out of poverty altogether. They haven't got above that poverty line, but they've made it above the extreme poverty line, which is a big achievement. And they've done that by a combination of interventions that are targeting different people at different stages or different levels of poverty. So at the real bottom, you start off with direct support or cash transfers or food aid. I think it's usually cash transfers. And then after a while, you start to build a savings culture, because what they want to do ultimately is get people into microcredit. They're very microcredit focused. But they provide skills training, and they also provide an asset at a certain point. So the asset transfer here is what lifts this program from just a social assistance program, which is enough to keep you alive but doesn't do much more than that, to a poverty reduction program, because the asset is a livelihood asset. It's access to land or an access to a cow or some other productive asset which will generate future streams of income. And once you've got that in place, then you should be up on an upward trajectory out of poverty. So with the combination of cash, assets, coaching or training, and eventually microcredit, you're supposed to move from extreme poverty towards a sustainable livelihood. Now, as I said, I haven't evaluated the program myself, but the evidence suggests that there's a lot of success, at least in terms of moving people up from very low level to a moderate level of poverty, not necessarily out of poverty altogether. Another example from Ethiopia, where the food security program also combines a range of instruments which target what they call the ultra-poor, chronically food insecure, and then eventually you become food secure. And food security is defined in a very interesting way in Ethiopia as the ability to feed your family for the entire year and to withstand a moderate shock. So that's got some notion of resilience built into it. And one of the critiques that people make about graduation thinking is that it doesn't necessarily mean that people are resilient against future shocks, usually, just that you've crossed an income threshold or an asset threshold or a poverty line, but there's no guarantee you're going to fall back, that you won't fall back. And this program, the definition of graduation includes a notion of resilience, that you can withstand a future shock. So again, it's a combination of measures. It's cash transfers or sometimes food transfers, which is the consumption support or social assistance component. And then there's also livelihood support, which is usually a livelihood package, like, you know, to help you keep bees so you can sell honey, that kind of thing, which generates an independent income, and that should put you on the upward trajectory towards getting food secure and out of poverty, or at least getting out of food insecurity. Okay, so graduation is one of those topics which is very popular, again, with donors and governments, because it gives them an exit strategy. If you don't have a graduation-oriented program, then you risk having a permanent program which is expensive, and governments and donors are very scared of committing indefinitely to programs. But if you have a program like this one in Ethiopia, where they said, the government said, within 5 years we want to have so many people graduated, and now it's been going for 10 years, so at the end of next year it's actually supposed to have graduated all the participants, which is a lot of people, about 8 million people. So we'll see. By next year they might have graduated all those people or not. And then what happens after that is an interesting question. Okay, so the second point about the systemic approach or systematic approach is that we look very strongly at rights-based approaches. We argue that a sustainable approach to social protection must be rights-based. And there are, interestingly, a range of examples of where this is now happening. And interestingly enough, these are all from the BRICS countries. So these are not the poorest countries where you tend to find much more resistance to introducing rights, especially to rights on claims from the state, which are very expensive. But in Brazil and India and South Africa, we find right to food in the Constitution of Brazil, which is an organic law for food and nutrition security, and a range of programs that are introduced to try and achieve the zero hunger objective, which is a very famous objective of Brazil's social policy. In India, we have a whole bunch of rights. I mean, India there's more rights than people in India, and there's lots of people in India. But there is the National Food Security Bill, which aims to guarantee food security to every citizen. And there's this famous National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme, now called the Mahatma Gandhi National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme. And that has this incredible guarantee that every household in rural India has the right to claim 100 days of paid work at the local minimum wage within their local area, which is incredible, really, because it is essentially a food for work or cash for work project, but it's completely reversed from a supply-driven, top-down approach to a demand-driven one. So that's real effective social protection, because it's people claiming their need for work or income when they need it, not when the project arrives in your village. So this is a small design change which actually radically alters the whole approach to public works. It turns it from a you're lucky if you get it project to a right that you can claim from the state. Of course, the issue in India is implementation. So you have variable implementation across states. In some states it's going quite well, in other states not very well at all. But the right is there, and it's something that other countries in the region are also adopting. It hasn't come to Africa yet, but hopefully it will come to Africa soon. In South Africa, we have, I'm South African, we have a range of social grants. We have 7 social grants, actually, which are all acts of parliament. So they're all underwritten by law. And there's an example from the child support grant, for instance, which was introduced in 1998 for children, poor children up to the age of 7. And we have a very strong civil society in South Africa, which mobilizes around lots of issues. And so the civil society mobilized and said, well, the Constitution says a child is any person up to 18, so you can't just restrict it to children up to 7. And so progressively it's been increased from 7 to 12 and 14 and now 18 years. So every child who is in a poor household under the age of 18 is entitled to get the child support grant. And currently that's about 10 million children. So it's a huge program. And the evidence, empirical evidence on impacts is very powerful. The social grants do have a big impact on food security outcomes. And one famous example that I've quoted here is if you're a child in a household where there's a pensioner, especially a woman, a grandmother, for instance, then you're going to be 3 centimeters taller when you grow up than similarly poor children that don't have pensioners supporting them. So the social pension schemes have been very important, not just for the pensioners themselves, but also for the children who depend on the pensioners. One thing that's interesting about the social grant system in South Africa is that there's no graduation thinking. This is all very much welfare, social welfare type thinking. And there's a debate going on right now about whether this is sustainable, because the links from social protection to labor markets are not very strong in South Africa. Brazil has been much more successful in actually getting people out of the social grant system by creating links to labor markets and getting people into jobs. And that's there's some lessons there that perhaps South Africa could learn from. because what we seem to see is social grants increasing all the time, but unemployment still being very, very high. Okay, the last issue is social protection flaws. Now, I'm sure most of you have heard of the social protection flaw. It's a very successful mobilization of the UN system, which was led by ILO with WHO. And in fact, it's now been approved as a recommendation. So it's all member states are now supposed to implement some kind of social protection flaw as of June last year. And social protection flaw is a very interesting idea because it's extremely ambitious when you think about it. What they're trying to do is make sure that every individual in a country has got income security throughout the life cycle, so children, working age adults, and older people, and also universal access to healthcare. It doesn't have to be free handouts of cash or health coupons or whatever, but you have to make sure that everybody is covered somehow. Everybody has access to healthcare either through their own means or through public provision, and income security for people that can't earn their own income, that aren't independent, don't have their own livelihoods, that must be provided somehow. So you must have, at some point, coverage across the entire population in terms of income and healthcare. So you have the horizontal coverage, which is the universal access, and then vertical means the level of protection. So after some time, you can start raising the benefits or the transfers that are paid to people to try and raise their income standards. But the first point is universal access. So it's a rights-based approach. It's very strongly rights-based because it says everybody has the right to healthcare, everybody has the right to income security, and based on the social security right. And the social protection flaws will be designed differently in different countries, but every country should try and achieve these two objectives. Now, in our report, we reviewed the social protection flaw, and we said, well, it sounds great, and we don't disagree with the idea, but it's not really focusing enough on food. So we had this discussion about whether the social protection flaw was good enough to guarantee food security. And this debate is actually ongoing right now. There was a meeting yesterday at ILO where this issue was discussed. And our argument is that income security is necessary but not sufficient for food security. And I think that the social protection flaw would argue that if you have enough income to buy food, then you are food secure. But we say that there are other things that also need to be done to achieve food security. So the CFS, when they received this report, they reviewed this discussion and they came up with a proposal, which is that the CFS Bureau should explore further ways of integrating food security and nutrition issues in social protection flaws. And that's where we are now. That's where the debate stands. So the social protection flaw is out there. It exists. It's going to be implemented in most countries. But we feel strongly that food security needs to be reflected more, you know, visibly in the social protection flaw than it is. So, for example, if you look back at the diagram, it says access to essential health care and minimum income security for all, which implies food security but doesn't actually state it explicitly. So we just think that there are ways that it could be made more explicit, and that discussion is ongoing between the relevant UN agencies and others. Okay, to conclude. In the report, we came up with a lot of recommendations. Some are for the CFS and some are for member states. And these are for member states. So some of the ones that I thought were worth highlighting. Firstly, we say that every country should put in place a social protection system that contributes to the right to adequate food for all. So the social protection systems should be focused on this basic right. We also argue in favor of twin-track approaches, a twin-track strategy that provides short-term assistance to people that are food insecure or poor, but also supports their longer-term livelihoods. So public works, conditional cash transfers, but any mechanism that provides people with the capacity to escape from poverty, not just a handout, is preferable to just a handout. But you also need handouts. Some people won't be able to escape poverty. We should also focus on vulnerability. A large part of the agenda on social protection has been taken up by people that are interested in poverty reduction, and they see social protection as a way of getting people out of poverty. But the basic objective, in my view, has always been to protect people against shocks and downside risk. So the old-fashioned safety net idea is still really, really important. And that means that social protection should be there when people need it. So it should be demand-driven, like the NREGA in India. And it should be scalable. It should expand when it's needed. So you can have a program which brings in more people during a bad year, during a drought or a flood, for example, and then contracts again when that crisis is over. We also argue that it should be underpinned. Social protection systems need to be underpinned by the human rights to food and to social protection or social security. You could, for example, put a framework law in place like they've done in some countries like Brazil, which specifies which ministries are responsible for delivering food security and gives you a list of programs and instruments that are going to try and achieve that. And so that's from the top. And then underneath, you need to have these accountability mechanisms I mentioned to make sure that actually there is some delivery on these on what's promised in the framework law. And finally, I haven't mentioned this at all so far, so I thought I should end with making this point. A large proportion of the world's poor and food insecure are people who produce food, smallholder farmers, and that's still the case, and will probably stay the case for quite a while. So we should not neglect agricultural livelihoods, and it's good that agriculture is back on the agenda for that very reason. So food security objectives of social protection need to focus very strongly on supporting smallholders who produce food. And that's my final point. So thank you very much. If you want to see the FAO report, there's the website. If you want to look at our publications, there's our website. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Stephen, for this very interesting and rich presentation with so much information and new conceptual and other ideas. And I would like to invite the audience to post questions and comments. Please introduce yourself and your institution.
I'm HRE, research coordinator. Thank you very much of course, it depends on the definition of DJI you mentioned, and you mentioned several times. You know, there are so many DJI problems, so you can fix it by changing the DJI. I think that DJI problem is much more related to the structure. For instance, the success of Bolsa Família in Brazil is closely related to two structural reforms outside Bolsa Família scheme. For instance, there is a kind of strong report about minimum wage, which was linked to Bolsa Família benefits. And there was a kind of universal healthcare system established in parallel with Bolsa Família. So it can avoid the kind of problem of avoiding the low quality private or public care system which were existing before the Bolsa Família. And then there was a strong reform in public education as well. So I think those kind of structural reforms were behind the Bolsa Família cash transfers contribution to elevate the food security problem. So, and your suggestion to fix the problems of public works you introduced, I think those suggestions are closely linked to structural reforms as well. I mean, without structural reforms like strong, decent work principle across the labor markets, whether it is possible to apply decent work principle to public works, I don't think it is possible. So there should be kind of a society-wide structural reform about decent work principle. So I think that the DJI problem cannot be fixed by changing the nature of that social protection schemes only. I think that should be linked to structural reform across the society. Thank you.
Would you like to respond to each question, or shall we collect?
Let's take a few, but I need a page, please.
Okay, we take that. Next on my list is Tom.
I'm Tom Labors from the University of South and a research fellow here at UNRIS. There are a couple of points. The first one links slightly to the former question. Certainly in Latin American countries and to a degree in African countries, conditional cash transfers have been associated with a progressive agenda and have been associated with reduction in inequality and even seen some people who claim that the adoption of cash transfers in Latin America was due to Latin American governments freeing themselves from the influence of the IFIs. it's interesting at the moment that in India, where the federal government has recently proposed a cash transfer program, a lot of the more progressive elements of academia have come out very strongly against cash transfers for a number of different reasons. They see it as threatening the employment guarantee scheme, but they also claim that in India it's part of a neoliberal agenda to privatise social services, education and health. So I was just wondering whether you could say something about how you think, in different contexts, cash transfers link to the wider policy environment. Mm-hmm. And also, with regards to the PSNP, you implied that you didn't think that the Ethiopian government was going to achieve its targets of solving food insecurity by the end of next year, but didn't quite go any further in talking about the extremely low rates of graduation that have actually occurred within the PSNP over the past 8 years, I think it is now. I was just wondering if you could say something about what you think needs to be done to address food insecurity in Ethiopia.
Thank you, Tom. I have Elena next to my list.
Hi, I'm Elena Gaia from UNICEF. I work in the countries of Eastern Europe and Central Asia on social protection reform. And I was interested to explore more the second part of the title of the report, which is about nutrition, and on which you didn't really elaborate. Especially the issue of adequate food, you know, which you kind of talk about. Because, you know, in the countries, for example, of Eastern Europe and Central Asia, we already have a floor of social protection because of the history. And what we see is that we are unable to convince governments of the effectiveness of these, especially the cash transfer component, for nutrition because of the low value and low coverage of these systems. And also, you know, one of the questions that we often hear from governments when we try to look at the effectiveness of social protection for nutrition is, well, then what is it more effective? You know, what among the menu of interventions that are, you know, globally discussed is more effective? Is it the school meal? Is it the cash transfer? Is it, you know, food rations? Or is it behavior interventions, looking at, you know, nutrition, education, etc.? So I was wondering if the report also talks about these issues, and if you could just highlight, you know, some conclusion if it does on this topic. Thanks.
Okay, I have...
My name is Sarah Traub. I'm a master's student at the Graduate Institute here in Geneva. And my question was regarding something you hinted at the very end of your presentation, when it comes to the differences between food security in rural or urban contexts. You hinted to subsistence agriculture. My question was, is one universal policy enough in contexts where, you know, where we have differences in urban and rural food security? So I understand that Brazil is quite an urbanized country, that, you know, maybe Bolsa Família works better in such a context. Would a similar policy, a universal policy, work in another context that's not as urbanized? Thank you.
Okay. Should I take two more?
Okay.
For the first round?
Yes.
So I take Shara and you after.
Yeah, I'm Shara Razavi. I used to be with UNRIST until 2 months ago, and now I'm researching data at UN Women. First, I just want to congratulate you for a very clear and yet very multi-layered and complex presentation. I think you covered a huge amount in a fairly short time, and it was very clear. I've been meaning to read your paper, but I'm only on page 37 of, I think, 100-page paper, so maybe I should read the paper and not ask the question. But just based on what you said, I want to pick up on the really important point that you made about income security being necessary but not sufficient for food security. And the question that comes up, in a way, I think I'm picking up on some of what Elena was asking. In terms of food security and the right to food, the examples that you gave, you know, of public works programs and conditional cash transfers, I mean, they are mainly about income security. So I'm still left with that question of how one can go from having social assistance type programs that provide a degree of income security to actually achieving food security, if that
connection is something that you question, and I think it's important to question that, because even having, you know, some income security will not necessarily guarantee food security and right to food. So my puzzle is, where are the mechanisms for guaranteeing a right to food? And moreover, I mean, how can one do that in a context where food production and distribution is so strongly market-driven, and not just national markets, but also global markets, where, you know, speculation in commodities futures markets sends food prices, you know, skyrocket in many countries, developing countries, where even developing country governments may not have the kind of financial capacities that are needed to provide the buffers that are necessary for calming down food prices. So my question is really to go back to the title and ask, you know, how does one guarantee the right to food or food security within such a such a context where markets are so dominant, using social protection instruments? Is that possible? And my doubts are about the social protection instruments that you mentioned not being very clear examples of enabling us to go from income security to food security, of making that link. So if you could clarify that, I think.
Okay, last question for this round. We have probably time to have another round.
Thank you very much. My name is Ernan O'Cleary. I'm from the Development Cooperation Directorate of the OECD. Thanks very much for a very interesting, excellent presentation and for a very good paper. I was just wondering, two questions. First one is related to the risk reduction instruments that you referred to as being extremely important, quite difficult to discuss or to advocate for. And the question really is, do you think that what you've done in the report, in the high-level panel of experts report, adequately advocates for them? Things like national price stabilization within national markets, food reserve, the use of food reserves, and trade policies. And if not, you know, if you can't do it through something like the HLPE and the Committee on Food Security, how can you advocate for those sorts of things so that there is discussion of those sorts of policies in the countries where you feel they're needed, which I presume are the countries in southern Africa and Eastern Africa? And the second question is sort of around the idea of the rights-based approach and the kind of legislative basis and the social contract idea. I think a lot of the evidence on social protection is that sort of even modest social protection programs and systems produce positive benefits, you know, that there is no threshold level and that a key to kind of to getting them going is actually having a way of starting small and building incrementally to build support for them. In some sense, if you're advocating strongly for a rights-based and a legislative-based approach, are you not in danger of setting the bar a bit high for governments that are going to be very nervous of entering into that kind of political commitment, which they might have difficulty delivering on, and which might bring them political problems and so forth? Do you have any particular advice that you think around taking an incremental approach in order to get ultimately to that sort of a situation?
Thank you. So please, Stephen, first round of response.
Can I sit or should I stand again? Okay, well, when you get a bunch of questions, what's always nice is that there are questions that you like and you can answer, and there are some that you have no idea what the answer is. But I will try and address all of them as much as I can. So the first point about, very interesting point actually, that you were saying that design issues need to be put in a broader context and look at the structural context. I think I totally agree with you. And one of the things that I'm concerned about in the whole social protection discourse really is that we are putting a lot of pressure on social protection instruments to solve a lot of problems which actually are not going to be solved by social protection. So, for instance, if you take the infrastructure deficit in Africa, you know, there's no way that public works is going to build all the roads and so on that you need to a sufficiently high quality. But we expect social protection to either compensate people for the structural problems of their livelihoods, which keep them poor, or to fill those gaps, which should really be addressed by sector-level or structural interventions or macro-level policies. So I totally agree, and I think that that's one of the points that I was trying to make towards the end, but I should have made it more strongly, is that the linkages to other sectors is about that. You know, a well-designed social protection program or system must be embedded within a good set of national development policies and sector-level policies. Of course, that's something which you'll just put in the report because it's not really our domain. But if you don't have that, it's really crucial, because if you don't have that, then the social protection policies are going to fail, or you're going to end up with permanent handouts without addressing the causes, you know, why you need to give those permanent handouts. So that's a dilemma, I think, that social protection is facing, is that because we've individualized the problem to households and people who get handouts, in effect, that sometimes allows the governments or the donors to avoid addressing the bigger problems. Okay, the point from Tom about cash transfers in India being opposed. I think I can see why that's the case, and this also is kind of follows on in a way, because one of the neoliberal critiques of social protection generally is this point about how it's individualized the problem. So if you have a structural change to an economy, if you have Washington consensus liberalization policies introduced and that creates food insecurity, then 20 years later you come along with social protection programs, but the problem was caused 20 years ago by liberalization policies that were misguided. So some of the mechanisms that were in place before, which have now gone, this comes on to another point I'm going to come to, those mechanisms might be better to reconsider, you know, and I'm thinking particularly of grain reserves and price stabilization measures, which are very unpopular. But cash transfers, for some reason, are extremely popular. So my argument is I can see the neoliberal critique. I can understand why people are opposed to the individualization of structural problems, which sometimes social protection is characterized as. But I think that they're also necessary. I think you do need to have social protection programs in the absence of good policies in other sectors. So maybe what we need is an incremental approach where you start with the safety net that keeps people alive, you know, keeps them adequate subsistence and all of those things. But at the same time, hopefully, you're not neglecting the important policies that are needed and reforms that are needed in other sectors. So you don't use social protection as a fig leaf for not intervening elsewhere. On the specific point about the PSMP, you said that I implied that the government is not going to actually reach its graduation targets. There's no controversy about that. There's no way they're going to graduate everybody. Or at least if they do graduate everybody, it'll be a political graduation. So what's happening in Ethiopia is people are being graduated, but they're not actually reaching the level of income and assets that were set out in the graduation guidelines. So the challenge now for Ethiopia is what to do when the PSNP ends, because they're in their second five-year cycle, which ends in 2014. What happens then? Will it be, you know, a national graduation ceremony where people throw their hats in the air and we've all graduated? And then next week we go back to poverty and food insecurity. Or will they, hopefully this is what's happening, will we start thinking about new mechanisms which will replace the PSNP? There's no doubt that public works will continue in some form, and there's probably going to be some kind of social assistance program which will continue to provide support to people that can't do public works. But the bigger question about food insecurity in Ethiopia is the perennial one. You know, it's been there forever. How do we deal with it? And my view is that the PSNP has had some success, but one reason that it hasn't solved the problem of food insecurity is it wasn't implemented as it should have been. You know, the design was very clear. You get predictable transfers for 3 or 4 or 5 years, which give you the confidence and the resource base to build up your assets and your livelihoods, and then you might get real graduation. But instead, for various reasons, they've rotated people in and out of the program. You're in for 6 months and you're not in next year. And there have been lots of problems in implementation, which mean that they haven't actually achieved what they could have achieved. But it has made a big impact, and that's one point. The other point I want to make about PSNP is it bothers me a lot that the problem of graduation or the failure of graduation is seen as a failure of the program. Because to me, it's not supposed to be about graduating people. It's supposed to be about protecting people. And the safety net, they emphasize the productive part over the safety net part. And I was in a workshop where an Ethiopian official was saying that he thinks the PSMP has failed because we've hardly graduated anybody. But without the PSMP, a lot of people would have suffered very badly in the 2008 rain failure and again in 2011. You know, if you look at Somalia versus Ethiopia in 2011, one factor was the PSMP was in Ethiopia but wasn't in Somalia. One factor. So I think it's more complicated than just graduation debate in Ethiopia, but how you solve food insecurity in Ethiopia is a much bigger question. Elena, about nutrition. This was a political issue with the report. We were told at the beginning to focus on food security by some people on the panel and by others to focus on food and nutrition security. And in the end, it was decided not to look at nutrition. And one reason for that is that the CFS or the FAO was in the process of revising their definition of food and nutrition security. So we were left with the old definition of food security, and during the course of the year, we were told we should be looking at nutrition security as well, but in the end, the instruction was leave it out. It's another agenda altogether. So in fact, we haven't looked at it, and it's missing from the report. But the point that you're making about how some countries in Eastern Europe have already got effective de facto social protection floors, which don't really focus on nutrition, I think is a really important one. And it comes to the point about income security being necessary but not sufficient for food security, because a large part of what happens between getting food or getting income and nutrition is about what happens within the household, what happens within, you know, caring practices, feeding practices, intra-household decisions about who gets what. And those kinds of decisions will determine individual nutrition outcomes, I think, much more than whether the household has so-called adequate income or so-called adequate access to food. So the food security, the right to food does not necessarily lead to a right to nutrition, I don't think. I think there's more work to be done in taking it to that next step. Right, what's next? Rural-urban, the rural-urban issue. It's interesting that most social protection programs, even when they claim to be national programs, tend to work mostly in rural areas, and especially in Africa. And that's my expertise. I'm not so sure about other parts of the world, to be honest. But in the report, we focus mostly on agricultural-focused social protection programs because of the food security connection. But clearly, urban food insecurity is a totally different issue which requires different interventions, I guess. I don't know of many. I've heard of one public works program in urban areas, but generally speaking, it's much more about market mechanisms, I guess, getting people access to food through vouchers and coupons and subsidies and cash transfers. But in rural areas, it's much more finding linkages to agricultural livelihoods. So a national social protection program, I don't think, is necessarily going to be the same program across the entire country. Or rather, you would need a rural social protection program and an urban social protection program as part of a national social protection system. But very often, we don't see that distinction being made in social protection programs or systems. Right. What are the mechanisms for guaranteeing a right to food? Yes. Personally, I agree that I think when I was talking about index linking cash transfers, there's a much bigger agenda behind that, which is that the right to food cannot be guaranteed when markets are so volatile and unpredictable. And one of the things that's emerged in some programs, including in Ethiopia, is a shift from cash transfers back to food transfers, because the right to food ultimately can only be guaranteed by giving people food. If you give people income, they might choose to spend it all on food, or they might not, and they might not be able to purchase the food that they need because the price of food starts rising rapidly, which happens. And even if they are index-linked, they're always catching up. They're always behind. So as soon as you have a food price rise, that automatically means that the right to food is violated if your cash transfer is based on the cost of a basket of food or a basic food staple. So I agree. Income security does not lead to food security. And one of the things that I think emerged from yesterday's meeting at the ILO is we should see income security as a means to an end, not as an end in itself. And the end, if it's the right to adequate food, might not be achieved by income security. It might be achieved by other mechanisms, or income security plus other mechanisms. Where you have volatile markets, there's no way that I think you can guarantee food security with a cash transfer. And then your point about risk reduction is difficult. Rights is difficult to argue for, or dangerous to argue for. I also agree with that, and I think maybe one of the points that I should have made more clearly is that I don't think necessarily we should be saying the right to food has to be introduced immediately in all countries, and that social protection programs should be rights-based, and you should have these accountability mechanisms immediately. We had an interesting discussion in writing this report, comparing countries where you have lots of rights, like India, but those rights aren't always realized in reality, with countries like Ethiopia, where you have these big programs going on, which are not rights-based at all. And in fact, you know, you have quite strong suppression of civil society. So where you have programs that are effective but not rights-based, of course we should support those in the short term, in the medium term. But we should, I think, be moving towards progressive realization of a rights-based approach. And that might require thinking about a pathway rather than, you know, forcing it onto countries before they're ready to take it on. I'm not sure I covered all the questions, but there were quite a few.
Thank you very much. We have still some time for a second round of questions.
Thank you. And thank you very much for the presentation. Anila Sherrosen from ANCTAD. And I guess my main question is about the links between the global level discussion about food security, commodity price volatility, to the regional level. Is there also a number of initiatives that are trying to emerge within regional economic communities, like ECOWAS, in terms of regional level food reserves? Then that fitting into the national level, the meso, and then the household level. The concern being, actually quite linked to what Shara was saying earlier on, how do you guarantee the efficiency of mechanisms that are designed within, say, isolated social protection initiatives, if they're totally delinked from what's happening at, within international markets, price volatility, and so on and so forth? And how do you also build bridges between initiatives of which the same international organizations are part of? I'm thinking, for example, of the G20 attempt to try to address speculation in commodity markets a few years back. The FAO was part of it, ANCTAD, the OECD, and yet the FAO is also really a big part of the CFS and HFP and so on and so forth. So are there channels where information flows are fitting into what is being done on one side and trying to make things a bit more efficient when it comes down to donor interventions at the national level? And when you mentioned at some stage about, yes, obviously there should be a needs assessment, also a government-led type of understanding of what they would like to have in terms of social protection assistance and so on and so forth. What are the spaces where all of this is coming into together and where we wouldn't be saying 5 years down the line, yes, obviously there should have been this, this, and that, but we couldn't because we had already designed our own donor policies, and this is what we're going to do at Timex. And the government saying, yes, we had put aside some money for social protection initiatives, but we hadn't actually really expected commodity prices to go all over the place again, and that now we don't have enough money, so it's not sustainable. So that's my main question. And the second one is to do with the rights-based approach. I'm just wondering to what extent is it really something that has superior value to say, more organic type of initiatives? And you already partly answered that, but in terms of enforcement, are there examples of, say, citizens taking to court their own governments because despite having this entrenched in the constitution, it hasn't been really, really effective? So is it just a powerful rhetoric or concept, or is it in practice helping, and why would we actually be going that way? I'm thinking of the parallel with the dispute settlement mechanisms when it comes down to trade agreements or investment contracts, where actually we're really talking about big financial efforts and things that governments, especially African governments, are often wary of because they know that they cannot follow when it gets really to the point of going to court and having to pay for everything that comes with it. Thank you.
Thank you.
actually, my name is Rita Johnson. I'm actually here on behalf of my daughter, who is the final year student of politics and international relations. University of Canterbury in Kent. And she said to me, because she's tweeting right now, she says, who in your opinion do you think should monitor the CCTs? As you have said, they are expensive to monitor and ensure. But some states will not have the facilities or resources to do so. And the last question was that, what should the state focus on more if they can't do both of them?
If they can't do both?
Yeah, if they can't do food security as well as social
protection. Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Yes, please.
Hi. From the North of Japan. I'm a bit puzzled by your approach to collective food. You mentioned that as a first kind of policy recommendation as well in your report.
Could you speak up?
Kind of going through the instruments to promote food security, you also mentioned that if you're a proponent of a wide-based approach, there is no room for all these different mechanisms such as differentiation, targeting, or graduation, because everyone has the right to food. And it's no wonder where you have societies that the majority of population is below those thresholds, you don't seem to find countries kind of with approach to right to food where you have this approach being promoted in non-rich countries. So I'm kind of puzzled by this, especially when you also read the report by the special rapporteur on right to food. It seems that the entire approach is totally dealing from theory and empirical evidence on the ground. It's just advocacy work, which is not really leading to anything. And then they're totally dealing from the arguments or the issues in relation to the major trade-offs between different rights and between different objectives, like right to education, right to health, right to security and so on. So how do you see the kind of benefit of right to food security or right approach in relation to bringing in really effective policy outcomes?
Thank you. I think we give the questions back to Stephen, and I just take advantage of being a chair also to pose one last question to you. There has been also a new idea thrown into the discussion from also the Special Rapporteur for the Right of Food on financing mechanisms that could help to realize that right to food, and that is about a global fund, actually, and there are some online discussions going on on discussing whether this is a good idea or what are the advantages. And I also would like to pose that question in terms of financing, because I think quite an important part of the barriers, as Stephen outlined, in terms of bad design and how design of social protection programs could be improved, actually also involves some sort of scaling up of funding, often for these programs, in providing a certain wage level, for example, if it's public works, maintenance of infrastructure, and so on and so forth. So there are budget implications. So my question, what your opinion is with regard to these ideas.
Great, thank you. Another set of interesting and challenging questions. I just realized that I didn't answer your other question about risk reduction mechanisms. Thank you. Yes, I would take your point very clearly that we did talk about some of these risk reduction mechanisms, grain reserve management, price stabilization, trade policy, and so on. I think personally, if I'm off the record, I would say that we took a slightly negative line on those, which was probably due to the fact that we were a team of five people. We didn't agree. On these issues, I think we were probably outvoted 3-2. So the people that were saying they were slightly skeptical about grain reserves and interfering in the market, let's call it that, mechanisms that interfere in the market, they pushed that line quite strongly, and we tried to resist it. But I think that the overall tone is maybe slightly too negative about these mechanisms, because, as I said, my own view is that I'm quite in favor of price stabilization in particular. I personally feel that stabilizing prices is crucial for food security and for achieving the right to food, and probably more effective and cost-effective than cash transfers or food aid. So we haven't pushed those strongly enough, and I'm not sure if it's going to get up the agenda again anytime soon, because there is a lot of resistance in international discourse as well to these kinds of mechanisms. Okay, Mila asked some very complicated questions about links from global down to the local level, and how to build bridges between different institutional actors and different levels. This is, to be honest, outside my expertise. I feel that there's a very important job to be done in making more coherent policies across agencies and across different levels, from global to local level, including regional bodies. But what my own limited experience or exposure to these is that the MISO level often tends to get sidelined. So you have a lot of action going on at the global level, and then you have national level outcomes. But what happens in between at the regional level, at least in the areas I work in Africa, AU, Southern Africa, SADC, and so on, those levels tend to not be as effective in guiding national policies. And I'm not sure if that's replicated elsewhere in the world. But I think it's probably important that we try and strengthen that chain all the way down. But what happens often is, for example, where you have member state bodies like the CFS or the ILO, then those decisions taken at the global level tend to go straight down to national level and bypass the regional. So I'm not sure how you can bring the regional level back in again. But at the national level, I certainly feel that the Social Protection Floor Initiative has been quite effective in terms of, firstly, getting consensus around this recommendation, and then, secondly, rolling it out to national level social protection floors quite rapidly and providing technical support for that to happen. So in that case, it's a very positive story, I guess, of how a decision taken at global level can lead to change at the local level or the national level. In terms of governments having spaces to drive the agenda, yes, again, this is a big political economy question. To what extent do governments actually set policy agendas where you have global fora and you have very powerful donors or international financial institutions having their own views about what should be done? And maybe to come to your last point about the financing issue, I think that mechanisms like the Global Social Protection Fund that's been recommended by the UN Special Rapporteur, and as he describes, as a mechanism rather than a fund, if it works, it has a lot of potential, at least to fill in some of these gaps and to provide some financing. But it's a long way from a document on paper and a recommendation in online discussion to actual implementation. So hopefully that will solve some of the issues, but it's got a long way to go before that happens. The question about whether a rights-based approach is more appropriate than an organic approach. Well, in fact, there are cases where governments have been taken to court. South Africa is a good case where civil society has taken government to court several times and won the case for example, for AIDS treatment, for ARTs to be extended to all HIV-positive people. That was civil society mobilization in the face of very strong government opposition. The case I mentioned of the child support grant being raised from 7 to 18 years is also driven by civil society. And not only that, but they've also campaigned successfully to have social grants extended to residents from other countries who have resident status in South Africa. So the social grant system has been dramatically extended in its coverage and its scope because mostly civil society has campaigned and in some cases gone to court. And one case is on the constitutional grounds that the constitution provides. And in fact, the right to food in India is another example of a campaign which led to the Employment Guarantee Act. It was, the story, which might be apocryphal, is that a person died during a drought in Rajasthan. And the Right to Food campaign took the government to court and said that this violates the constitutional right to food. And in response to that, the government introduced the Employment Guarantee Scheme as a way of getting people access to food indirectly. So they were responding to pressure from Right to Food, and that's where the Employment Guarantee Scheme came from. So there are cases. And at a local level, there's many, many stories of projects where you have a complaints mechanism which is very effective in terms of dealing with a lot of complaints that people were left out unfairly, and then they get on the program if they can prove that they should be on the program, or with cases where payments were delayed or they didn't get their full payment. And those projects have got very effective complaints mechanisms or social audits which actually achieve these kinds of rectification outcomes. Okay, the question from Rita's daughter, who should monitor CCTs? CCTs are usually monitored by social workers or the ministry that's implementing the program itself. So the challenge is where you have very weak ministries of social work or social welfare or community development or whichever ministry is running it, and not enough people to actually do that monitoring. And that's why I was saying that I think CCTs do raise the costs of these programs very high, and they introduce this bureaucratic complexity, which sometimes derails the ultimate objective of social protection. So you don't find CCTs in countries where you have very low administrative capacity, because there simply aren't enough social workers on the ground or community development workers to do the monitoring. And I like this question, how do you choose between food security and social protection if you have to choose one or the other? Well, I think one of the points of this title, Two Sides of the Same Coin, is that we do think of social protection as a set of instruments that try to address food insecurity. So in a sense, I think you don't have to choose in the ideal, well, not in the ideal world. In reality, a well-designed social protection program, social protection floor as well, should go a long way to addressing food insecurity. If you have income security, you're not necessarily going to be food secure, but you're more likely to be, or you're going to be a lot closer to being food secure. So social protection programs that are well-designed and well-implemented and comprehensive and so on can solve a lot of food insecurity problems. So I don't think we need to talk in terms of choosing. And the last question, I think your point about does the right to food mean that you can't introduce targeting, you can't have graduation objectives, you can't have conditionalities? I think that is a very complicated question, really. I think that a right to food, the right to adequate food, can be guaranteed in many ways. And it's possible you could do it by a conditional cash transfer, but then you'd have to design it in such a way that you don't actually punish the person for not upholding the condition by withdrawing their cash or their food entitlement. So you could have a soft conditionality, for example, where you do a casework approach, where you visit the household and try and support them, but you don't actually withdraw the cash transfer, because that would violate the right to food that the program is trying to support. So I guess it's possible to design programs, even targeted programs, can be rights-based, because, for instance, if you have a private sector pension, then you don't need to have a social pension. So you can target people that don't have private pensions, and that can still be a rights-based approach, because everybody is covered by some kind of pension, even if you're targeting social pensions only to those that don't have private pensions. I think it's not necessary to make trade-offs here. We need to find ways of designing programs so that we can achieve the ultimate goal, which is social protection for all, and then beyond that, the right to adequate food for all.
Check out our other podcasts, available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.